Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own.
Jonathan Sparrow with us. He is the author of Overload, How Too Much Information is Hazardous to Your Organization. He's the CEO and chief analyst for Basics. That's www.basics.com, a research firm focusing on issues companies face as they navigate through the knowledge economy. He's recognized as one of that industry's leading thinkers and pundits, having pioneered the study of knowledge workers and how information technology impacts them. And Jonathan, hi, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael Ray. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about, I think that the title of the book in and of itself says it all. Overload. How much is too much information? It can be hazardous. Jonathan, do you think that businesses that you've gone into, consulted with, looked at, researched, there's just so much out there that they get buried in that melee of information and don't get the job done?
Well, to me, it's death by a thousand paper cuts. You don't really realize what's happening. A lot of this is so insidious that moment by moment, the inundation continues. And at the end of the day, you don't necessarily realize that you've lost about 25% of it to information overload-related problems.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with people, obviously there's a tremendous amount of people out there in the workforce, and those people are responsible for how we live our lives, the delivery of information, the economy, the food we eat, et cetera, the culture. And in essence, if they don't get the information correct, if they're overloaded and they're jammed, it's going to affect that person at the breakfast table, isn't it?
Yeah, it impacts everyone. There are around 78.6 million knowledge workers, meaning people who work with information on a regular basis in the U.S. alone. But just using that figure, information overload costs the U.S. economy approximately $1 trillion in 2010. And we lose anywhere between 15 to 25% of our day to information overload. We simply don't realize it because, as I mentioned, it happens in such small little cuts.
Oh, no question. And I would venture, not to be political, it doesn't matter left or right, but I would say that the administration, whatever administration is in charge of the country at the time, have got to run into the same thing, department after department and committee after committee, organizing the committee that organized the committee, and they've got to be slammed with overload.
Well, a very good example was the transition from the Bush administration to the Obama administration when the Bush administration deposited its archives, which were over 10 times the amount of information that the Clinton administration, which had also run 8 years, had deposited. And they had to go literally into an emergency mode to figure out, what do we do? How do we accession? How do we absorb all of this information and stuff? And I'm not sure if they've still gotten it all cataloged yet. I tend to doubt it.
No, by the way, the other thing, too, and I know you address this, you get all of the information, and it's the reliability of the information. Big problem there. How do we know that the information that we're getting is going to be the absolute best for what we want to accomplish?
Well, the key here is to use authoritative sources and to use multiple sources, as well as to learn how to use search tools if you're using search tools to search for things. A lot of people don't really understand how rudimentary our search tools are. Google is very powerful, but if it gives you 564,768 results, it's kind of a deer in headlights syndrome. You're just looking at it, wondering where to start. People need to go and understand very simple search arguments like using and or near, things like that when using search. Or they also need to understand, and just to think of the very, very famous cartoon that was in the New Yorker about 20 years ago with a dog sitting by the computer, that on the internet, you know, no one knows you're a dog. And if you keep that in mind, you really don't know if that beautiful website is authoritative, if it's legitimate, or it's just pretty and there's a 13-year-old entrepreneur behind it.
Well, absolutely. And I think the other side of that is we're overloaded with so much, and this happens to me, I think it happens to anybody, distraction. You get absolutely distracted. You're doing something, you have to stop, then you have to go back to what you were doing. And in the interim, you thought about something else, and it gets away from that focus.
Yes. Well, that's what actually led me down the road to go more in-depth in the research that I've done in information overload. Around 6 years ago, we uncovered a really interesting phenomenon, which I named recovery time. Recovery time is the time it takes you to get back to where you were before you were interrupted. We found that it takes, on average, 10 to 20 times the amount of the interruption to get back to where you were. So I could interrupt you for about maybe 30 seconds of your time, but by the time you're back in the flow of things, and you don't really realize, you don't look down and say, okay, I'm going to start getting back into the flow of things now. But by the time you do get back to where you were, if indeed you return at all, you've lost about 5 minutes on average. So when this adds up, if you think of all the interruptions you get every day, that's a good part of the 15 to 25% we believe people lose.
Now, by the way, Jonathan, what segues right into that is when you use the word lose, that distraction, how much does that cost?
Well, that's really part of our overall calculation. We know that information overload overall, as I mentioned, costs the U.S. economy $997 billion. I'd say more than half of that is comprised of the distractions, the unnecessary interruptions, plus the recovery time, keeping in mind that the recovery time is actually 10 to 20 times the amount of the actual interruption. So when we can get rid of a few unnecessary interruptions and distractions, we are not only saving those precious seconds, but we're getting back all of the recovery time that we otherwise would have lost.
Yeah, let me give you a prime example of that. Let me give you a prime example. Exactly what you're talking about happened. We had part of the organization didn't come in at the right time, and then when I took a look at what I had, I got overloaded with information. There was too much at one time. I picked it up, and it was everything you said. It was the, quote, the reliability of the information. I'm not seeing it right. The distraction, looking at two things at one time. The diminished productivity in getting the intro out the way that the intro is supposed to be. And it falls right in line. And everything that we do on a daily basis, and you don't have to be a multimillion-dollar corporation to run into the same thing. I think this hits every individual as opposed to major companies and businesses.
It's true. It's non-discriminatory, to say the least. And the unfortunate thing is that there's no real magic bullet for fixing this, and it's likely we're never going to resolve the problem. One of the reasons I wrote Overload was, however, to bring attention to the problem, because what I found is raising awareness of the problem helps lower the amount of information overload we get. And permit me just to give an example or two. One of my favorite pet peeves is people's tendency to thank everyone for an email. To write, I can't tell you how many emails I get every day with two words. They are great and thanks. And each time you get an email, regardless of whether there's something of great import or it's great, thanks, it's the same initial interruption. You stop, you lose focus on what you are doing, and you try and continue. Especially when people feel they need to reply to all 300 or 3,000 people and say, great, thanks, think of how much time is lost. Just doing that to 300 people costs us approximately 8 hours of work time. For every hundred people who are unnecessarily copied on an email, we lose 8 hours. So it's things like that. Be considerate. I keep telling people, think about who has to know this information And do you have to acknowledge it with a great thanks and all that? Think about the recipient. The more you do, the less likely we are to fall off a cliff in terms of the problem.
Oh, no question. But how do you deal with this? And when I say how do you deal with this, you can go into the administration of a company, and you start with the CEO, CFO, whoever the top person is at that point. You sit down and you lay out the program to them, which I think the program's brilliant, Jonathan, so I'm on your side with this whole thing here. So you sit there, you lay it out to that person. That person brings it to the subordinate. Now, the subordinate ends up bringing it to their subordinate, and by the time it gets down to the last person on the list, quote-unquote, we're back up to the dilution, the diminished productivity. How do you get it to a point when you walk into a company that from level to level, what the information that you're imparting stays focused, stays accurate, and keeps that power behind it that it had when it first started with that person on top?
Well, every company's problems would be different. Some companies may be mired in email. Others may have problems just getting information out to customers. Others may have problems finding information. No two companies are really alike, but there are some commonalities in terms of the types of things that we see over and over and over again. The example I mentioned about email, for example, is you know, it's ubiquitous. If you start by example using restraint in communication, don't CC the world. The other thing that really irks me is the inability for a lot of people to write clearly. People don't necessarily read what they write. People combine multiple themes and ideas in a single email. Sometimes the most important thing is one paragraph below the bottom, or above the bottom, excuse me, and I might as well be below the bottom. But we found in our research that people only read the first paragraph and a half on any given email or document. So if you have your key ideas in paragraph 3 or 4, they may never see the light of day. I think that if everyone in an organization starts to understand that each person bears a role in this and that the actions of one person can indeed turn an entire organization around, then we have something very powerful going on. And it's very simple. Read what you write. Read what others write. Keep to the topic of the subject line. Keep your messages short and to the point. And perhaps most importantly, value your colleagues' time as if it were your own. Now, if I can expand on that for 1 second, one of the things we found in our research is that society itself has gone on a tear towards a need for instant gratification, and that happened around the same time that we started to see a great rise in the feeling of self-entitlement by people. Combining the two is deadly, because someone who feels both self-entitled and who needs the instant gratification, they need right-away answers, feels no compunction about going in and interrupting, saying, "Michael Ray, I know I just sent you an email 2 minutes ago, but you haven't replied, and clearly what I'm doing is far more important than what you're doing." That happens every day in companies.
Sure.
Over and over again.
And what that does, that starts the contest, quote-unquote, and that starts the dilution of the effort of the entire company, because now we're off focus and we're getting into who's right, who's wrong, who's better, and that's one of the things I think cost us probably another $1 billion or so a year in the inability for a company to produce, to do what they're supposed to do. Jonathan, we're starting to run out of time. Is there an email we can find you at?
My email is jonathan@overloadstories.com. And I'd also like to invite people who do read the book or want to read the book to visit a unique aspect of the book on the web, which is the companion site. The book doesn't end with the last page. We developed a website. We're actually still in the process of developing it. And it allows readers and potential readers to tell their stories on how they've dealt with an information overload problem. And we print them all on the web, and we discuss them. And we haven't even launched this completely yet, but people can email us stories at stories@basex.com. And we'd love to hear what all of your listeners have to say about their own information overload struggles.
By the way, can we buy the book on the website?
Yes, the book is available at overloadbook.com. We tried to make it simple and not overload people with a long URL. So overloadbook.com. And it's available as Kindle, Nook, and, of course, as a bound copy.
Wonderful. Hey, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael Ray, thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Matt Whitfield with us, features editor, Yahoo Entertainment. Matt, hey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, I should have won.
Oh, I agree with you. Heinz Ward certainly shouldn't have won.
I've got to tell
minute,
you.
Wait a minute, you guys. I should have won.
Okay. Well, all right. One of us should have won. But I think when they threw Christie out, I can't believe they did that.
What do you mean when they threw Christy out?
Well, she didn't win.
I know, but Chelsea should have won.
Oh, Chelsea, not Christy. Whatever
yeah,
her name was. Yeah. I was busy watching O'Reilly. What can I tell
no,
you?
He wasn't. Okay. Actually, I roped him into watch. He was into it. He was into it.
It's about time. We're in the 12th season. Come on.
What can I tell you? Man, I'm slow.
Wait, he's still getting over Sabrina. I think that was like the second show, the second season. So I said, like, get over it, you know. But really,
no. Chelsea should have won. I was watching that, and I can't believe. And I think that whatever her name is, well, she was on O'Reilly too, wasn't she? No. What's her name? The one who lost all the weight.
Kirstie. You know what? I am glad though that she made it to the finals because I think she deserved to be there.
What's that got to do with dancing?
I'm just saying.
Well, reality TV rarely has anything to do with whatever actual event that's taking place. So, it's all about the people who pick up the phone and vote for the contestants, and that's why Kirstie Alley made the finals. But she also did a great job this season. I'm definitely glad to see her in the final three last night. I never expected her to win, but I truly was surprised that Chelsea went out in third place and wasn't even in the running when it came down to the final two. I thought she deserved to win the whole thing.
Yes, it was a crime. Really, it was horrible.
Look, I don't want to say anything bad about Heinz Ward. He was very consistent. He was a lot of fun. His partner, Kim Johnson, had her best season ever. Do not get me wrong about any of that. but he was not the best performer out there. But again, it's my fault. I didn't pick up the phone to vote for Chelsea last night. A lot of people probably didn't, and Steelers Nation was behind Hines Ward, and that's why he took home the trophy.
You know what was, if you take this back, by the way, and I voted, and it still didn't help, but I'll keep voting. If we go back to, now I lost my train of thought. Ah, it was the week before last, Matt, when they had the...
Excuse me, it happens with age.
Yes. Yes, Michael, we'll forgive you. One for Radio Susie. Okay, so going back, I think it was 2 weeks ago when they had the bonus points.
Right.
And what was very interesting, when push came to shove, Chelsea got it because she is the better dancer. And what was also very interesting, which made this very special this season, is that they all scored perfect scores for the free dancing.
Which was ridiculous because none of them really deserved a 30, but the judges were just tossing those 10s out back to back. And it was kind of just, it kind of annoyed me, to be honest with you. But if we look back at the history of Dancing with the Stars, Osmond should not have beaten Maya or Kelly Osbourne. You look back at season 3, Emmett Smith shouldn't have beaten Mario Lopez or Joey Lawrence. So this is nothing new for us. We know that the best dancer doesn't always win. We know this with American Idol, the best singer doesn't always win. So that's part of the deal with reality TV. The fans just have to suck it up, but you know, 20 million people will tune in to season 13 when it debuts in the fall, and the train will keep on chugging down the tracks.
Yes, it will. And this season, I think what was really a little different, too, is there wasn't any clear forerunner. I mean, I always felt after week two that Chelsea should be it. But there
exactly.
wasn't.
I mean, last year we knew as soon as Jennifer Grey walked out onto the ballroom floor that she was the front runner for last season, and she obviously ended up winning the Mirror Ball Trophy. But this year, like you just mentioned, there was no clear front runner. I mean, I thought that Chelsea and Romeo were both great from the get-go, and I thought that they would both make it relatively far, but nobody thought that Hines Ward was going to be in the finale.
Right, yeah, and I think he didn't even think so. But you know what, Nat, talking about Hines for a minute, he is extremely likable. I mean, who cannot like this guy? I mean, all he has to do is smile. And he did a great job, but yes, was he the best? No. I think he was.
He wasn't the best, and I feel like the judges were giving him high scores, higher scores than he deserved all season long. Again, this is not me saying that he deserved fives when he was getting tens. This is me saying he probably deserved a few eights when he got nines or a few nines when he actually got tens, and I think it made a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, consistently, the judges were saying all along that he was consistently the best.
Exactly, I mean, and it kind of blew my mind. I think that Chelsea was the best dancer. I know that you agree with me on that one, but I think what really hurt Chelsea this season was the choreography, which, again, was not on her. Her professional partner, Mark Ballas, is the one who choreographs their routines. And I think through the beginning of the season and even into the middle for some of the season, his choreography was too out there, especially for, you know, judges such as Len, who prefer the traditional ballroom style. And I think that really, you know, bit her in the behind. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why she didn't win.
I think early on, it really did. And perhaps, who knows, perhaps they were really trying to reach that younger demographic. We don't know. But, you know, it's not unusual for one of the pros to do that. And I always say, I don't get that. Why did they do that? I mean, what's the point? And I think the other thing with Chelsea was that she was younger and the fan base wasn't there. I mean,
if we're being honest with each other,
yes.
I mean, nobody knew who Chelsea was unless you were probably 10 years old and watched the Disney Channel. I had no idea who she was, which, you know, yes, she made it to the final three, but at the same time, having that built-in fan base and having a recognizable face and a name really helps people. That's why Ralph Macchio and Kirstie Alley made it as far as they did.
Absolutely. In fact, even it was yesterday, I believe, on Kelly and Regis. You think I watch a lot of TV. Actually, I
you
haven't.
You keep talking about Kelly and Regis like they're your favorites.
Well, that's when I'm working, you know, when the day's starting for me and it's quiet. And they have a good, I think, a good barometer. And they forgot to mention that Chelsea is going to be on their show tomorrow. They mentioned Kirsty and they had Hines today. And I saw this on The View, not that I watched The View. I really don't even watch TV. But no one knows, no one knew even well, to the
wait,
end
me,
about
let me,
Chelsea.
Wait, let me hold you up. Let me hold you up.
Yeah.
You watch The View? Okay. Go back and I'll be quiet.
Will you forgive me?
Well, the other funny thing was last night they brought out a lot of the past, you know, the contestants from this season, and they showed Romeo, who went out in fifth place. And he got out on the dance floor with his partner, and mm-hmm. he was amazing last night. And it just proved that, again, the best dancers don't always get into the finale. And in my perfect world, it would have been Romeo, Chelsea, and Kirsty in the final three, but I knew that was never going to happen.
Right. And you know what? You and I liked Romeo from almost the start. And I
exactly.
Think
I mean, he was so talented and charismatic. And he really was a better athlete than so many of the other dancers out there, and I really think that he was robbed. I mean, this is by no means the robbery that occurred last season when Bristol Palin knocked off Brandy, but Romeo was good enough to make the final three.
I agree. And, you know, the other thing I like about Romeo was for a young person, he really was so, he had a great attitude. And I loved when he did his best with smooth dancing. And I remember he was dancing to Frank Sinatra. I thought, you know what, that's incredible for a young person. I mean, he almost did better at that than some of the Latin dances.
I completely agree with you. His, you know, presence out on that ballroom floor and the way that his shoulders and his arms were just perfectly structured
yes.
when he took on more of the classical dances there. And, you know, I never thought that he was going to make the finals, but he did a great job. I do think that it will help him in his career, but it'll be interesting to see if Kirsty, Chelsea, and Hines can really capitalize on this. Obviously, Hines is going to be back on the football field if they, you know, get through the strike that's happening right now. His career his path is already set for him, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with Kirsty, Chelsea, and a few of the other people in the cast.
Well, I think Kirsty, I read on the internet today. I mean, she said this is it for reality TV. Not in the bitter way, but she's looking for. She already signed a movie deal, so this is a huge plus for her. The weight loss, where she came. I mean, this is wonderful for her.
I agree. I think, you know, Kirsty, just like Kelly Osbourne, they kind of had the opportunity. They had been on other reality shows that didn't necessarily put them in the best light, and Dancing with the Stars was able to turn their careers around, you know, revitalize them, put some more money in their bank accounts, and I think that we'll be seeing a lot more of Kirsty in the coming year for sure.
Matt, what was a little bit of a surprise was when Jennifer Grey was on, we haven't heard anything about her for her. She just disappeared after Dancing with the Stars. That should have been her springboard to get back into the celebrity that she is.
I agree with you, but I have the feeling that maybe she didn't want to. I mean, we can't just say that she's not on our TV screens because she didn't get offers. She's a mom. She has young kids. Her husband's already on a TV show. And maybe she was happy winning the Mirrorball trophy and then just, you know, putting her sweats on and enjoying her. You know, she's rich enough already. She doesn't need to be working. And, you know, not everybody needs to go out there and, you know, break their backs after they go on Dancing with the Stars to capitalize on it. But, you know, that story is kind of fishy. We never know really what happened with Jennifer Grey right there.
You know who needs to come back? And I'll tell you, I can tell you right now, next season, you know who's going to be dancing? I know already. Schwarzenegger.
Charlie Sheen.
No, yeah, Charlie Sheen and Schwarzenegger.
Oh, no.
Arnold Schwarzenegger would be a very interesting candidate for season 13 of Dancing with the Stars. I don't think that he would last beyond a week because I don't expect anybody to pick up the phone to vote for him. But no. That would be a lot of fun.
And that poor female professional. Ugh.
No, there would be another loss. I mean, we got that one down.
Well, there are a few other people, though, that I'm looking forward to for the next season. I mean, obviously, Kirsty Alley's best friend is Kelly Preston, who's married to John Travolta. She was in the crowd the entire season. So I think that she's making a major push to get on the show. We won't have any current football stars like Hines Ward because hopefully the NFL season will get underway. But I'm looking for, obviously, another 80s star, maybe like a Molly Ringwald or an Elizabeth Shue, because they've had such success with that Jennifer Grey and Ralph Macchio from the past two seasons. And obviously, there needs to be another Disney teen star. So I think that maybe Ashley Tisdale or Vanessa Hudgens or somebody that used to be on the High School Musical scene will definitely be in the mix.
Whatever happened to, you mentioned her, I haven't heard her name for years, Elizabeth Shue. Whatever happened to her?
She was in a movie last year that I loved called Piranha 3D. It was a trashy horror film, but you know, she's made a few appearances in films here and there, but she's married to the Oscar-winning director behind An Inconvenient Truth, so again, she does not need to go to work, but I would love to see her out on the ballroom floor or Molly Ringwald.
No, I thought she was I loved her as an actress. I loved some of the things she did, and I thought it was great. You know, there's going to be some interesting people that will be on, and Ralph Macchio, there was something missing in him. Nice man, very sweet man. I mean, there's no question about it. But there was this drive, this something that wasn't there. And he was just about ready to fizzle out just about the time that he did. And they, you know, obviously they counted him out. But there was, he'll get into something. I've watched, he'll do something, and then he disappears. And I wonder,
he didn't really attack it this year. He started off the season incredibly well, but then by the middle of the season, you just started to see him fade towards the middle and eventually the back of the pack because, you know, again, sweet guy, but he never was really on the offensive there, and I think that really, really, you know, caused some trouble for him. But who knows? It'll be interesting to see what happens with him, too. I mean, from Karate Kid to My Cousin Vinny, and then he was gone for about 15 years. It'll be interesting to see if he's able to capitalize on his, you know, new 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah, and now the next season starts when?
September.
Okay.
Usually so, like the third
week. September, and it'll be interesting to see if we maybe have another Palin in the mix. That always helps ratings.
You know what I thought was interesting, and I've watched this time and again, in Dancing with the Stars, they'll show you some flashbacks of some of the people that were dancing, and I caught a shot at Sarah Palin in there. I don't necessarily know that she was there. The more I think about it, they could be using some celebrity flashbacks of who's been in the audience
true.
And tie that into the show itself, because there was no reason for Sarah Palin to be there.
Well, it was a star-studded group there last night. I did find it surprising to see her in the audience there. It very well could have been, you know, stock footage from when she was there rooting for Bristol, but I also wouldn't be surprised if she wanted to get one of her other kids on that show so she could get herself back in the spotlight.
Oh, she's in the spotlight,
believe me. She sure is.
She's in the spotlight. I still bet any amount of money that she's going to be throwing her hat in the ring pretty soon. Watch and see.
Well, it'll be interesting. I don't know if her last venture into reality TV, Sarah Palin's Alaska, will help her with that. No. But I would not be surprised to see her throw her hat in the ring myself.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. It's going to be a very interesting way to go here. And thank goodness we don't have the judges that are on Dancing with the Stars electing the president.
Exactly.
You got that one. Okay, Matt, website we can find you.
You can find my content across all of Yahoo's entertainment properties, and you can also find me on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Wonderful. Talk to you soon.
We will regroup.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Good
night. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. I am sure who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Dresser After Dark. And welcome back. We are talking money right now. Eric Tyson with us, and he's the author of Personal Finance in Your 20s for Dummies. You got to love it. He's an internationally acclaimed and best-selling personal finance book author, syndicated columnist. He's a speaker, and he's worked with and taught people from all financial situations, so he knows the financial concerns and the questions of real folks just like you. Now, despite being handicapped by an MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business and a BS in economics and biology from Yale, he still remains a master of keeping it simple. Eric, welcome to the show.
Eric is not with us.
Oh, I'm not going to reach him. Okay. Well, if Eric's not here, we'll talk finance at a later date. Maybe the angel from above can press the magic button.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are.
That's okay.
I hope your troubles are few.
That's okay. No, I didn't hear you in a second. Well, let me just take a shot. By the way, when I'm playing the music, can the audience hear me?
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other.
Okay, that's the answer. Yeah, okay. So,
I've been in love with you.
You'll still be coming.
And I know how.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance.
And each night we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics that you want to hear and the people who know to bring them to you.
We're fine.
So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS radio network.
You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Singer-songwriter Angelica Milado is with us, and she's the author of Remember Who You Are, The Story Behind the Song. She's performed across Europe, Canada, and the U.S. Angelica, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, you have an amazing story. You were brought up in communist Romania, forced to abandon your musical dreams, and you had a controlling former husband, and you were watching the Grammy Awards one night, and that's what did it. That's what lit that light bulb up, and you got determined to go after your dreams in North America. How easy was it to make that break, or was it a tough break to make to get over here?
Well, it was a very long journey, first of all. When I first came to Canada, I didn't even know how to speak English. Mm. So imagine, I felt almost as if I was born again in a totally different country, felt very much alien to everything that was going on here, the customs, the people, the language, absolutely everything, the school system, like down to the street and everything else. So I had to literally learn everything from scratch, which I did. It wasn't easy, as every immigrant can tell you, but
sure.
With will and determination, you can do anything in life. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Angelica, we're talking, I don't even know if I want to say this, over 100 years ago, my grandfather was from Bucharest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, and I went
to university to Bucharest.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Now, I wouldn't remember him, but I mean, he was from Bucharest. That's where, obviously, my father started out from. And he went from Bucharest to Russia, to Turkey, and then back. But when we look at the world, it seems to get very small once you get accustomed to where you are and the culture. What was the difference between living in Romania, communist Romania, and Canada?
Oh, where would I begin? It's entirely different, at least at the time when I left 15 years ago from Romania. Romania was different then than it is now. As you probably know, we had the revolution in 1989, and we are not communist anymore there. So the country is going through a humongous transition, and it's very different than even 15 years ago. So, but what I can tell you, up until the point when I left, everything was different. As I was saying before, the streets, the people, the language, the school systems. We had the food rationed in the communist regime. Women would wake up in the morning at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, trying to get milk for their children. Because otherwise it was just a very limited amount of milk, for example, and you had to wake up really early in the morning to catch a liter or 2 liters of milk for your children. Again, everything was rationed. You couldn't talk freely outside about the president or anybody else in the government, or your parents would go missing. It was just a totally different world. We had, for example, bananas and oranges only at Christmas. We didn't have them throughout the whole year like they're here every day. So it's pretty different. Again, I'm not putting a negative on that, because no. That is obviously what shaped me into who I am today, and made me even a bigger fighter and a person who dreams for bigger things. And I very much appreciate where I'm living right now. I remember when I first got my first car 10 years ago here in Canada, I was literally thanking God every day. I was driving on these roads, and I was saying, thank you, God, for these beautiful roads and this beautiful car. And, you know, it's just everything is different. And
I think the name of the book in and of itself, Remember Who You Are, that women had a completely different position there than they do in Canada. Wasn't that the case?
Were women respected
the way they are in the United States and Canada? Did they have that same respect, or were women maybe pushed aside and pushed down?
Well, not as much. I don't think there's a big difference in that sense. Women were always respected there, and we were doing fine. Maybe the only thing that I would see a difference when it comes to women is that here, there is much more stress on women here. They have jobs 9-to-5 and sometimes second jobs, and then they have to take care of their children, do laundry and all these things, and they're much more stressed here. But other than that, I don't think there is a big difference in the way women were respected there. It was fine.
there was a question, because I didn't really know where to go with the base of that, because in different countries, we have the different cultures, and those different cultures obviously have different standards. But it's the remembering who you are. Deep down within us, there's usually that something that most people hide. And it's not so much remembering. Some people never know who they are. And when you can get to that who you are, that essence of you, then you can remember you've got something to tie to, and you become, there's that freedom that goes along with it when you get that sense of actually being.
Yes.
Now, in the go ahead.
Yes, no, in my book, Remember Who You Are, it refers mostly to the passion that every single one of us has inside, and we can be very much and feel very much fulfilled in life if we just find that passion that we have. Many people nowadays just get jobs because they know they have to be providers for their families, and they don't really have time to think of what they're really passionate about. So what my book and CD are about is trying at least to start, take baby steps and try to find what your passion is. And I'm not suggesting in any way that, you know, you should leave your job and get into what your passion is full time. That's not always possible, but even if you started as a hobby, you will feel much better. I think you would, you know, feel much happier. And that's what I think, and I noticed with people around me, is that when you don't do what you love, it has many repercussions. It's not only that you're not happy during your job and then you come home and you're fine. It has a domino effect. You're not happy with your job. You wake up in the morning. Many don't feel like eating, come home frustrated, take it out on their spouse or probably who probably doesn't do what he loves either. Now you have two people frustrated, yelling at their children. So what's the example that the children will eventually follow that all this is normal? So that is my message in my book, that the best gift you can ever give to your children and to anybody is to support them and inspire them to follow what their passion is.
And I really believe when you talk about passion in and of itself, passion has to do with expression. And it's that deep down something that allows a person to express and be heard in their world. For you, it's singing. When you sing, there everything inside of you comes out. And people that haven't found their passion, and it doesn't have to be within a job. They can keep the same job. You just said it. They keep the same job, the same way of life. But when they get that inner something that allows them to express, and more important, be safe in that expression, the world turns around.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah, that's really where it is. Now, the book in and of itself, the book is your story, correct?
The book is actually what came first before the music. I always loved writing. I always, even as a child, I used to just put my thoughts on paper. So after I came to Canada, you know, the new experiences and the challenges were like a pool of inspiration for me to write. So I kept writing. And my husband kept encouraging me, you should start writing music too. But I was not as confident to write music. So one day I just thought, why don't I just go through my notes, my writings, my stories, and try to pull out the essence and turn it into lyrics. So that's what I did. That's how I did it. I turned the essence of each story into lyrics, and then the music just came to me. So once I was done with all the songs, I recorded the album, I decided to put all these stories into a book form. Along with my biography, an epilogue, some more thoughts that I have about this passion that I'm talking about. And I put the book together with a CD, and so far it's been very well received.
You know, on a much minor level, that, you know, so many people, and I'm going to say, have gone through the same thing that you went through, and that's what they would recognize, not to the degree that you did coming to another country, not speaking the language. But at the same time, there are people get out into their own world and they get lost. And language doesn't necessarily have to be from a country. There's a cultural language, there's an emotional language, and there are people who don't speak a language that connect with other people. And I really believe in all the years that I've been doing interviews and I've looked at the world through my eyes based on my own experiences, music in and of itself, there's a vibration in music. And there is a language in music, even if there isn't words to it. And music in and of itself is one of the things that allows a person to touch their soul. Most people can't get to it any other way, but music seems to be the vehicle to open that door to actually get there.
Yes. And I think the combination of the music and the words, so it's really up to every person what they feel that they resonate better with, music or words, or it can be anything. See, with my book, after living the experiences that I lived and seeing so many unhappy people, I decided to put this book together. And I'm not in any way suggesting that this book will solve your problems, everybody's problems, because it won't. But it can, through maybe one word or one little note in my CD, you know, just touch someone's heart in a way that they didn't expect and understand something that they heard it before better.
Yeah. So, now, by the way, from your press release, and you believe that everybody, really deep down there, everybody's a pure, passionate, and a loving spirit, and forever ready for it to unravel unlimited possibilities. It's that key. It's that one certain something for everybody, and it's different for everyone to unlock that ability to do so. And if they recognize it, they can move with it. But most people go through their life, Angelica, and they don't recognize that doorway to move through because they're frightened to death. If they do, somebody will think this, etc. But it's taking that step.
Yes, and it's not only that, Michael. You know what else? Many people look outside themselves and compare themselves with others. I'll give you an example. I was in Chapters here in Toronto for a book and CD signing, and this wonderful lady came to me and she said, you have such a beautiful voice. I wish I could sing like that. And I said, can you sing? She said, no, I can't at all. I wish I could. I said, okay. No, she said, I don't have any song in me. I said, what? How can you say that? Don't say that. You have a song in you. It's just waiting to come out maybe in a different way. It doesn't have to come out through singing. So many people look outside, look at other people, and they say, oh, I wish I was, you know, on the cover of that magazine too, or I wish I was an actor like that too, or I wish I could sing like that or dance like that. And they fail to look inside and see what they're good at, because I truly, truly, honestly believe that every single person is good at something.
Angelica, they miss one thing, and they miss that when they look in the mirror that there's only one you, and no matter how somebody can work with it, they can only be the second best you. You can only be the second best someone else. So your real job in life is to be absolutely the first best you. And I think you're absolutely right when we compare. The comparing, that you can't compare equally. So it's called go out, live your life, the best you can live your life. And when it's over with, you can look back and say, I did it for me, and I didn't have to compare myself with anybody. Angelique, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website? We can find the book and your music.
Yes, it's www.iamangelica.com. I have also a gift for the listeners, which is a free song download, my original song, You're My Reflection. Also, my CD and book are available for sale at Barnes & Noble throughout the United States. And again, it's called Remember Who You Are, The Story Behind the Song. And I will be soon touring in the United States at selected Barnes & Noble locations. Everything will be posted on my website.
Wonderful. Angelica, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just...
T.L. Keller with us. He is the author of The Total Novice Guide to UFOs, What You Need to Know. His lifelong interest has been in space exploration, extraterrestrial intelligence. He lives in Palm Springs, California, right in the desert, and that's where you know when the UFOs are around. He studied UFOs and worked in field research for over 50 years now. His latest book is based on 55 years of research and field work in UFOs. He's an aerospace engineer and a graduate of the School of Engineering, University of California at Los Angeles, and he's got a master's in business administration degree from the University of California at Berkeley. T.L., hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Ray, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Let's go all the way back to the beginning for you. What
sure.
was about UFOs? What caught your attention?
Well, I'll tell you, believe it or not, I was about 10 years old, and I was in fifth or sixth grade, and one of my schoolmates loaned me a book called Flying Saucers Have Landed by George Adamski. And I thought to myself, well, gee, could this possibly be true? And then later on, I read a book called Flying Saucers from Outer Space by Major Donald Kehoe. And he had a number of connections at the Pentagon, and went through a very detailed analysis of what had been observed by various military pilots. And then I realized that there was some reality to UFOs, and I've been studying this ever since.
Now, Tail, let me ask you this, and I'm not trying to ask you how old you are, but you know, in what time frame was it that you started to take interest? The reason I'm asking that is our cultures change every decade or so, and it's even happening more rapid. The way we looked at UFOs when I was a kid and the way we look at UFOs today, it's a different look. So something had to catch you that had that overarching theme of this is what's constant, this is what's below it, and this is what we have to learn about.
Right. Well, I'm 68 years old, pushing 69, and I started reading back in the early 50s. George Adamski put out his first book alien beings from some other world.
Now, T.L., let me ask you a question. This is critical, so I know how to deal with this tonight. What month is your birthday?
What month? December, actually.
December?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, wait, December what?
27.
Ah, okay. You're going to have to respect your elders here because I turned 69 November 14th.
Oh, okay.
You have to bend to the elder wisdom.
My elders. However, I have never assumed that I was always getting the straight answer from my elders.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You know what I mean.
I'm right here to, if you need guidance, I'm right here.
No, well,
by the way,
I got you about
4 or 5 weeks, so this is the elder speaking here. Okay, and by the way, and the reason I asked the question was, you know, very simple, was that we do look at it differently. And the way you got captured then and what you saw in the movies then was completely different than what you see now. The technology, the ability to say, maybe this is real.
Well, that's true. But you see, back when I was 10 years old, I figured that they were real in some way. And that's what I'm going to tell you tonight, is that some UFOs are really hard, solid objects.
Yeah, by the way, I completely believe that. I couldn't prove it, and if you wanted to find science is something that's provable, but I completely feel the way that you do. I believe that we cannot be in the billions of miles of space that we have out there that we haven't even explored and goes beyond our ability to reason or fathom, that how could we be the only living intelligence in all of this space?
Well, that's true, of course. When you listen to Carl Sagan when he was on television running his series on Cosmos, he would always say there are billions and billions of stars in the universe. And that means that there are billions and billions of planets that have some kind of intelligent civilizations on them. But then, you see, he would say, of course, UFOs aren't real because the distances are just too far. But anyway, that's understandable since he was being funded by the government for his research work.
Now, by the way, when we take a look at this, now, and stop me if I'm wrong here, I haven't done a tremendous amount of research on UFOs, but there's a bit that I know over the years. You talk about Area 51. I just heard, and this is the other day, that it was Area 51's, you know, quote unquote, very secretive because there's many programs going there that nobody wants anybody to know about. We were doing things with aircraft before the basic public knew about it. But from what I understand, they were saying that it wasn't extraterrestrials, that they're aliens that were there, but they were physically engineered Russian military that was there.
Oh, you mean life forms that have been created in a laboratory?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. And you've heard that they're Russians?
Yeah, I mean, this was only about a week or so. Yeah.
All right. Well, some of these 3-foot-high beings that have been reported are considered by many, in part, some of them, to be actually created biological beings, created in a laboratory. I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians were doing it. I believe that the American government is also doing it.
And by the way, even if we were doing it, why hide it? You know, in this world that we have such open, or supposed to have such openness about what's going on, that these kind of experiments, obviously there are going to be groups that will be standing up and demonstrating, no, don't do it. But for the most part, why hide it? You know, if we understand that there's this kind of technology, wouldn't that in and of itself, Teal, give us some hope that our medical advancements, you know, the cures for certain things could totally be possible with coming from the same basis of information?
Right. I couldn't agree more. Unfortunately, this technology is buried deep in black projects. And I don't see any immediate release of this information coming out, personally. If they did, it would affect our energy infrastructure. It would affect our transportation. It would affect our pharmaceuticals, and it would affect our communications industries. Beyond that, it would obviously have an effect on social order to some extent,
sure,
and possibly a religious effect. So the if they were to release it, it would have a rather monumental effect in just about everything that we do.
Now, by the way, absolutely no question about that. I can see it from technology to religion to spirituality. No question about it, because what we have learned is we're linear. There's a certain amount of things that we can fathom, and there are things that we can't fathom. Even if it's explained to us, it's not recognizable. It's not something that we deal with constantly. So if I was the one in charge of doing this, what I would do is just let it out a little at a time, get people used to it, and then just build from there.
Okay. Well, let's look at this. Who's to say that certain powers that be, let's say in the Pentagon, for example, haven't been doing this very same thing? You know, I have seen a photograph of Steven Spielberg being escorted into the Pentagon by the former Secretary of Defense, Cohen, and they had an honor guard at the entrance. Who's to say that he hasn't produced these two films of his with some sort of guidance or suggestion or requirement that his films produce a certain effect or storyline? Now, just for your information, and I'm not here to plug Steven Spielberg in particular. However, on June 10th, he is releasing a new film of his called Super 8. You may have heard about it. And this is about Area 51. And I would suggest that your listeners might want to go see this, because this might be quite revealing.
So this is really what we're talking about, letting it go little by little, because I really believe that we are in a tremendous information age, obviously, now. But at the same time, everything that we believe to be so over the last 50, 60, 70 years seems to be falling apart now. The people
yes.
are different mindsets. So the timing for it, if it happens to be so, and Spielberg has that information, maybe we should be looking at something like this, where we can find some kind of balance, some kind of homeostasis that would bring everybody together and move in one direction.
That would be wonderful. And I welcome that day. I will tell you that there's a bright part of this story. And the bright part is that there is existing technology, although it's hidden very deep into black projects, like I say. But there is an existing technology that will allow for low-cost, pollution-free electrical energy to be generated. And this would mean an end to much of the use of gasoline and diesel and aviation fuel. And we wouldn't have these nuclear reactor meltdowns like in Japan. We wouldn't have Chernobyl. We would not have Gulf oil spills. Courtesy of BP or ExxonMobil or any of the other companies. And as far as I'm concerned, the sooner we can do this, it'll be best for the world. And unfortunately, there are powers that be that do not want to have this information released. And I'll tell you another thing, if I may.
Sure.
One of those elements is big oil. Now, I used to work for Mobil Oil Corporation at their headquarters in New York City years ago, so I think I have a pretty good handle on how they work and how they think. Big oil intends to pump crude oil and natural gas until basically it's finished. There's a commercial running on television and on the Internet, maybe you've seen it, right now. From ExxonMobil, and they have a petroleum engineer there that states that they have enough natural gas to pump for the next 100 years. Well, the subtitle should be, we also have enough oil to pump for the next 100 years as well. And I have every suspicion that they plan to do that. And they don't care about pollution, you know, they care about their stockholders. So, My point here is that there are a number of industrial interests that are holding back on the release of information like this.
Absolutely. TL is going to kill their income, and that's really what we're dealing with. It's that old follow the money trail.
That's right.
That's exactly
follow the money trail.
Yeah, and that's what's going to stop the information from flowing. You realize the billions, not millions, but the hundreds of billions of dollars these industries would lose.
That's correct. Think of all of the gasoline stations. Think of all the these crude oil tankers, these super tankers. I've actually been on in one, and they're big.
Sure.
Think of all the infrastructure that's been invested in distillation plants and tanker trucks that take to distribute the oil and the gasoline products and aviation fuels. There's all this is big money,
sure.
And they're not about ready to just toss that out of the window just because people want free energy.
Now, how would you feel if you were in business and somebody walked in one day and said, we're changing your program to this. We're doing it tomorrow. Now you're out of business. Where's my income coming from? Where are all the things that I've established in the control and the power and everything else that goes along with it? Absolutely.
That's right.
There's no question.
They wouldn't like it. And
no.
You have to keep in mind that ExxonMobil, last time I checked, was the biggest corporation in the world. So
I've talked to some of their executives over the years, with oil spills and so on and so forth. And you're right, they're very powerful. And the oil industry is a very powerful industry. And the oil industry is not going to let things go that easily.
That's unfortunately correct. There'll be a big impact, no doubt, on an international basis. But this is gradually coming, and eventually we'll all be driving electric cars. That's sort of the bottom line, and it'll take years to get through this transition. But it's coming.
What I can also see is this: if it came too fast, based on what we're talking about here, you could look at your Third World War coming right now. Look at all those the countries that are dependent upon their income because of oil, Brazil and so on and so forth, Middle Eastern countries. Then I really believe if it came too fast, those that the powers that be would find a way to maybe not stop it but slow it down. And I do truly believe that there would be war.
Mm-hmm. I believe so too.
Yeah,
and that certainly obviously needs to be
addressed,
be stopped as well.
Is it we older people think that way?
Well, you know, not all older people do. You know, it's always the generals that send the young men off to war, you know. And so the young men who end up being injured and
no question about it. Let me ask you this. I picked the book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What is it that I walk away with that I didn't have before I read the book?
Okay. Well, basically, it's this. There are two types of UFOs. And what I'm going to say is very puzzling to people. What I'm going to say is this. There are two types of UFOs. There are those from other parts of the galaxy or other galaxies, and there are those that have been manufactured here in California. Now, the ones that are manufactured in California are built in the Antelope Valley. This is where Lancaster and Palmdale and Edwards Air Force Base are located.
Sure.
And they're manufactured under a 6-decade contract from the U.S. government to build anti-gravity technologies. These companies are Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and General Electric. And they've been working on this program for literally decades. And they're at quite an advanced stage of development and testing. These things actually do mimic or behave like what you would classically call a UFO. Now, they're not all necessarily disc-shaped. There are triangular-shaped devices, too. And often these devices are observed by the general public, and, of course, then it gets reported as extraterrestrial. But it's not always. And the problem is, when you see it, you can't tell whether it's made in the Antelope Valley or on planet Serpo.
You know, and I'm wondering also, we're starting to run short of time, but I'm wondering also that there are so many times, TL, that we hear about a light going across the sky, something that somebody has seen. Look at those. What are those called? In the when you're up above and you're looking down and you see those circles in the farmlands. What are those
crop circles?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
You know,
right.
Where do they come from? I'm asking the question rhetorically. Where did they come from? These are things that the average person have no idea, and average technology is not going to be able to produce what we end up seeing.
Right. Well, some of them were made by an English couple by the name of Doug and Dave, And Doug and Dave came forward years ago saying that they made the crop circles. The problem is that there were too many of them. And when some of the crop circles were being formed, flying discs were also seen at the same time. But let me answer your question. Besides the fact that UFOs are real, the next major point in my book is that there are two space programs. There are two U.S. space programs. There's a white space program, which is a space shuttle, the International Space Station, the Mars rovers, and in other words, all of the space programs that people normally see. These are the ones that are announced for public consumption. But at the same time, there is also a second space program, which I call the Black Space Program, and this is the one that basically takes crash retrievals of extraterrestrial spacecraft, and they retro-engineer it to find out how it works. And what they're doing is creating what is normally called alien reproduction vehicles. In other words, a look-alike of an extraterrestrial vehicle that operates in the same way. This is going on in a facility called S4, which is 12 miles south of Area 51. Now, my third and last point is this, and we touched on this earlier. There is a solution to Earth's energy crisis, and this technology is also buried in these black projects. There is a way to create low-cost, pollution-free electrical energy, and we just need to bring that out into the light of day.
Well,
that's basically the sum of my book.
TL,
500 pages, by the way, printed in full color. We have a satisfaction or your money back guarantee, and my website is thetotalnovicesguide.com.
TL, wonderful. I was going to ask you if we can get the book on the website, right?
Yes, we can. I also will say that it's available through Amazon and through any good book seller.
Got it. T.L. Keller, we got to go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us, and interesting stuff, more than.
Michael Ray, thank you very much for the invitation.
Take care.
Great.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithfully.
I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael O'Grady up next, selling at the kitchen table.
Like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Michael O'Grady with us. He's an accomplished sales manager. He's a coach. He's an author. And he's an entrepreneur. And during his 20-year sales career, he has set and achieved many, many industry records, as well as his personal goals. And he's dedicated to inspiring others to do the same. Michael, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much. You know, when we talk about sales today, sales today is very different than what sales were 20, 25, 30 years ago. we have a brand new consumer out there. There's an e-consumer out there that has access to more information than we know what to do with. So as it transitions, how would we define selling today as opposed to what it used to be?
Well, you know, it's funny, Michael Ray, because, I mean, if you think back years ago, I think a lot of the values that people had had to do with character, you know, what kind of character did you have? Were you a person that looked out for others' best interests? Is there an element of caring there involved? So I think to be successful, those never change. I mean, we certainly have technology that we have to deal with today where people are doing all sorts of research on the Internet. But that's just a matter of you knowing your service or product inside and out. I think if you take those character traits from years ago, you'll do just fine.
Okay, but there was a time when, you know, if you break down basic sales, get the hidden objection and so on and so forth. There are areas today, Michael, that I really believe that when we're talking about somebody selling something, the world, from what I've seen so far, nobody likes to be sold anymore, but we love to buy. And it's framed in that way as opposed to instead of selling it, if we frame it in a way that they want to buy it because we have that same consumer again. I can go to my internet right now, hit Google if I want to buy a car. Michael, I can go to any car dealership. I can find the car that I want. I can find the Carfax. I can negotiate a price. I can buy it right over the computer. So I believe in my heart of hearts, it's framing in such a way that you are different and they're going to want to buy it. They call themselves to action based on what you've said.
You know, my background is primarily in selling to homeowners. You know, I've been in the contracting business for over 20 years, you know, mainly in the plumbing, heating, air conditioning business and also the remodeling end of things. So my career has been spent going out and sitting across the kitchen table with a homeowner has had to do some type of renovation type work in their house. So the I guess the technology today really is, you know, what type of efficiency ratings, what kind of government rebates are available, things along those lines. But overcoming objections really comes back to, you know, are you asking good questions and are you a very good listener? I mean, I was years ago taught this phrase, you know, you're born with two ears and one mouth for a reason. Use them in proportion to one another. And that means you should ask a question and then learn to shut up and listen to what the answer is. And that person will do exactly what you said at the beginning. They'll tell you how they buy.
Sure. I mean, no question about it. And I think listening is a very important area. And then we take the bridge, the transition from listening to hearing. And I think that's critical also. One of the reasons where I think guys like yourself that are doing what you do now are so important, that we have a brand new kind of kid coming up and the new culture, and they don't think the way people thought 20, 25 years ago. It's almost a completely different language, and most of them don't understand what it's going to take to bridge that gap between yourself and that potential customer that you're making your offer with. So I think it's critical because salesmanship is not innate. It's something that has to be learned.
Well, I think it's something that has to be learned, but you also, you know, either you're a friendly person or you're not. Either you're someone that naturally gets along with people or you don't. And part of what I talk about in the book is the different personality types. Now, this has to do with, you know, who you are as a person and how you make decisions, and then the person that you're meeting with, how they make decisions. So it's critical that you're doing a lot of reading. There's a book out there, People Smart by Tony Alessandro, and it breaks down the four different personality types where you have your, you know, dominant directors, which are the take charge type people, you know, then your interacting socializers, which are the ones that just will talk all day about everything but what you're there for. You know, your steady relators are more the estimate getting researcher types, and then your cautious thinkers are the ones that, you know, they just can't make a decision. They're the type of person you go out to dinner, they're the last person to actually place an order. So if you do some homework and you learn how these people make buying decisions, you know, it's going to change the way you present to them.
Now, also, too, aren't there combinations, Michael, combinations of those people? You know, obviously, you know, you got the last one, that thinker who analyzes everything and is not going to give you a decision right now, no matter what you do. But you've also got combinations, you know, your socializer director. It can be a combination of the two, and it's really recognizing what that is and saying it in a way and I know you're saying this, but saying it in a way that they hear what you meant by what you said, because there's so many people you can say the words, and they're going to add their definition of the word, the connotation of the word, and by the time it hits them, it's not anything near what you meant. So that, number one, getting those personality types going is one thing, but also making sure we say it in a way that they hear it.
Yeah, and you can't, you know, I had this experience within the past year where I was out with working with a company where they needed some help. They had one of their salespeople, their numbers seemed to take a dip, and just couldn't, the closing rate seemed to drop off, and he didn't understand why. And in the first 20 minutes of being out with them, his name was Tim. He was running this page by page, I guess we call it like a cookie cutter presentation, and he didn't miss a word. You know, he certainly followed the presentation to a T, and he would ask a question, but he wasn't asking the question to achieve what you just talked about. He wasn't asking a question to find out what the answer was. He was asking it for the purpose of just asking the question in the presentation. And there was no back and forth. There was no interaction between him and the homeowner. And eventually, that's why the person's closing rate had dropped off, and he was really getting what he deserved. People didn't want to buy from him because he didn't show that he cared about what their answers were and changed his approach to how they buy.
Yeah. Now, by the way, very interesting when you're talking about the right questions. I've seen over the years so many people, Michael, they ask the wrong question and they get the right answer to the wrong question and they never get anywhere. And you're right. You're absolutely correct. You've got to know what the right question is to be able to stay on track and stay focused for what your end result is.
Yeah, there's this all came about years ago because I developed when I had my own, you know, quote, struggles. In this business, I started reading and writing, and I had to put my thoughts somewhere. So I developed a website, which is, you know, www.sales-psychology.com, and it's a resource for anyone in the sales business that can go to for whether it's understanding personality types, how to understand how to get in and out of certain situations, and just what you talked about, how to ask that right question. So in the book, you know, Selling at the Kitchen Table, A Contractor's Guide to Closing the Deal, you know, we cover that whole spectrum from asking the right questions to setting up the structure of your presentation to you know, even referrals and networking.
No, by the way, I think referrals and networking is so critically important today. And what we've got, that there used to be that, 6 degrees of separation. You'd get a referral, you'd network, and you'd get, what, maybe 10, 15, 20, 100 people. My goodness, if you do it right now, you can get 100 million people listening to what you have to say. and wouldn't it be wonderful to be in a position where you can't make all the sales because you don't have the time to?
Sure. And with all the research you could do, I mean, you still have to, you know, do your homework even when you're doing your networking. I mean, you want to make sure you get your network of people, and if you're going to do some type of email campaign to them, or whether you're on Facebook or Twitter or whatever the case is, you have your close friends, and you're absolutely right. You can quickly get a mass amount of referrals just because of your own network and who you're linked to.
Now, by the way, when you're dealing with a client, there's something that I know you talk about, this, that immediate trust. What is it that they're going to feel and see in you that's going to cause them to allow you to be able to do what you're doing and they're comfortable with it?
Well, I think that there's really no trick to doing this. I believe that if you're an honest person and you have integrity in what you're doing, then when you're talking to someone, if you're looking them in the eye, if you're asking questions that, and then showing them that you're listening, you know, an active listening, you know, you're nodding your head as they're talking, you know, you're making sure you're jotting down notes, and then you're following up with a question that matters, you know, all that builds trust. And not trying to sell them something they don't need also. Yeah, I hate when I walk into situations and I've heard that someone was presented something or you know, tried to be pushed something that they really didn't need. I mean, sometimes it's okay. If somebody doesn't want to buy something, that's okay too. Now, I've had that situation where you actually walked away from a sale because it made no sense. What they wanted to buy just didn't make sense. Sure. And in the end, I've gotten referrals from that same person because they knew that you were trustworthy.
No, by the way, absolutely. I think there's no question about that. And, you know, I've heard people say over the years, many, many times, is, you know, what are you selling? What is it that you're selling? And I hear, you know, I'm selling me, I'm selling a product, I'm a whatever. You can't sell yourself. They can buy you, but it's not really you that they're buying in the first place. It's what it is that you can do. And I have watched people stumble on this for so many years. They don't care about you. They don't even care about what you have to offer until they can experience and they can feel and see that what you offer will benefit them. When you hit that point, up to that point, nothing's going to mean anything. But when they hear the benefit for them inside what it is that you're saying, that's when it all begins. And most people miss that.
Yeah, and you know, it really links back to what we were talking about originally. If you're walking into a situation and you have, for example, an estimate-getting researcher that is this steady relator type personality, and they are very business oriented. They don't want to talk about social. They don't want to know how what kind of house you live in or talk to you about the car they drive or how the kids are doing. You know, they're there for business. And when you walk in the door, you better recognize that right away. And not be jumping too hard. I have to build rapport with this person, so let me pull something out of my butt that has to do with nothing that I'm here for. And you almost turn that person off. You know, focus on what they want, give them that, you know, let them ask their questions, and then eventually you're going to stumble upon and see something that you do have in common, and those probing questions and back and forth will eventually lead to some more trust as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the probing questions, it's to sit down and the biggest problem that people have today, nobody listens to them. I mean, realistically, nobody listens. And if you did, you in the general sense of the word, if you did what you were just saying a moment ago about listening to what they have to say, that in and of itself is a benefit because most people, they walk through life frustrated because nobody cares about what they've got to say. But if you sit down and you listen to them, and I really believe it takes it two steps farther. And I think the biggest mistake people make in sales today is, you know, the old analogy between the drill and the hole. You go to a hardware store, you want a hole in the wall at home, you're doing a project, and the drill, you go to get a drill, the drill's going to make the hole. And the question would be, you know, are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? 80% of the people is going to respond, you're buying the drill. You're not. You're buying what that drill can do for you. And the hole takes it the step beyond features and benefit. The hole is the benefit of the benefit. It's the perceived value of every individual out there. And I think that's really where the key is. And it's the difference between, and I'm going to say audience. It could be one person across the desk or 10,000 people. And the key really is to be able to say it in such a way that everybody understands what you mean by what you say and they perceive it, because that hole is so critical. 90% of the people is the difference between reaching 10% or 90% of the people that you talk to, the drill in the hole.
Sure. You're using that analogy, which is great, because the book, it's Selling at the Kitchen Table, A Contractor's Guide to Closing the Deal, and it's really geared towards the tradespeople, because that's something that tradespeople just don't know how to do. They can communicate all the technical and mechanical of what they're about to do, but and they'll you know, I call it tech talk. They're using the technical names for things, and they're talking over someone. And a homeowner's not going to sit there and tell you they don't understand. They're going to nod their head and pretend they get what you're talking about, but they really don't. Sure. So you have to keep it real. You know, keep it. The drill in a hole is a great analogy, because I tried to keep things as simple as you know, this thing here blows the air out of the vent. This is what heats up. This is what cools down. You know, keep it real simple so they can understand it.
Yeah, and even taking it a step farther, when you're hot, it does this, and when you're cold, it does that.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know what it boils down to, and I love this. If I were to say, what is your book about? What's your book about?
My book is about being yourself, letting people buy the way they buy, and really making it easy for them to buy from you because you're being real, you know, you have integrity. But beyond that, it's helping people realize that it's the transition from your own goals, your mission and purpose in life, and those goals have to be to help others and really look out for their best interest. So in a nutshell, you know, it's gaining trust, helping others, and good communication.
Okay, Michael O'Grady, I'm going to become Michael O'Grady. Ask me what my book is about.
Michael O'Grady, what's your book about?
You. Did you hear that? It's about
my
every,
book?
Yeah, it's about you. Not Michael O'Grady, but you, the person
right.
that you're trying to reach. And I think that's realistically where it is. It's about you. And as long as you're talking about me, the audience, your potential customer, I'm going to listen to you. But the moment
sure.
it's not about me, it's about a pipe, you lost me.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I got it. Hey, Michael, thank you. Hey, by the way, I really appreciate you being here, and what you've got to offer will help a lot of people, especially in this down economy when people are confused about what to go and how to offer something. And now, one more time, your website that we can find you at.
You can go to www.sales-psychology.com, and you could purchase the book at sellingatthekitchentable.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael O'Grady, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael Ray. Have a great day.
Take care. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dan Kaufman coming up, Life in the U.S. Military.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray, and welcome back. You again. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I can say that. Dan Kaufman with us throughout his more than 5-year career. I talk for a living, Dan. How about that? Well, you know, let's just get right into this thing. I think that the title, in and of itself, "Life in the U.S. Military: Images for Reflection and Reminiscence for Veterans with Memory Loss." Very important. There's so many of these kids that go in and they're living a normal life. And when they come back out, and I was military also, but when they come back out, there's something different. You go from a life of just an average person. You go to high school, you go to college, you got a job, whatever it is. Now, all of a sudden, your whole focus is on protecting, and you could kill somebody out there or be killed. So let's start this way. Dan, what was it that triggered you to put this to pen?
Well, I'll tell you, it was personal experience, Michael Ray. My dad, 30 years ago, fell victim to dementia, and he was a veteran. My mother was his primary caregiver, and I saw firsthand over a 10-year period what happens, the progression, the downward progression. MacArthur, 60 years ago, said, old soldiers never die, they just fade away.
Yeah.
But if they have memory loss, they fade even faster.
You know, and stop me if I'm wrong here, but and I haven't really delved into this, but the memory loss, is it memory loss due to a psychological impact, or is it something physically that's happening to them? Is it at a point where they don't want to remember what they've been through, what they've done, and not wanting to face it? That's a question.
Well, let me share with you that the original premise of the book was for Alzheimer's and dementia and other causes The original premise of the book was for World War II, Korean, and Vietnam-era veterans. However, in our trials around the country, what we came to find is that even veterans of the Iraqi conflict in Afghanistan and more the more recent conflicts, that these books triggered something remarkable. And so that we have expanded the premise of the book to include memory loss from virtually any cause, and that includes traumatic brain injury as well. So, again, the original premise was for the those veterans who were reaching the age of 60, 70, and 80 years old and moving into the realm of dementia. But what we've come to find is that this unique book, and when I say unique, you know, what is the word unique? It means the first of its kind, the only of its kind, and this is exactly what it is that I've created. It just happened, Michael Ray, that I stumbled upon this thinking, and it is the very first, and it is so unique, and it works so exceptionally well that I'm actually blown away. I'm totally blown away by the reaction with veterans with memory loss to the life in the U.S. military. This is the fourth title in a series of books that is planned to be a series of 50 titles for people with memory loss. This is the first one that's devoted specifically to the U.S. military. One book covering all five branches, and it is simple and an elegant, extremely elegant, a very high quality, made in the USA, beautiful hardcover book that feels good in the hand. I wanted to produce something that if my dad was still alive and I could put it in his hands, that he would really get a kick out of and say, that's a fine book. And what we've created is a fine book. And the images are of those common experiences. Nothing relates to battle. There are no weapons shown in the book. But what is shown is the bugle call in the morning. What is shown is the salute and the flag being raised. What is shown is the barracks. What's shown is KP duty and basic training and a USO show with Bob Hope, images that are and a Jeep and a buzz cut, and they're beautifully rendered. That, you know, I'm an artist, and this was a very interesting artistic project for me. After immersing myself in the medical side of it, I'm a layperson. I'm a layperson, like pretty much a majority of the people in the world. I'm just a layperson who has had a personal experience that's very profound. And the Internet has allowed me to research as if I was a student of cognitive therapy. And I became one. I became one, and I studied, and I created something, a series of images, in this case for life in the U.S. military, and in the cases of the other titles, other subject matter, that is so intensely perfect, and the way it's even arranged on the page, the eye goes right to it, and even people who don't have memory loss get a kick out of it and find that their mind is triggered to think about an experience with a Jeep or an experience with a canteen or a helmet. It's a remarkable book. And so we have declared war on veterans' memory loss, and there are 600,000 veterans with memory loss. There's 6 million Americans suffering with memory loss. 10% are veterans. It's a remarkable number. There's no other group that has that type of percentage of memory loss other than specifically men or women. But so veterans with memory loss, 600,000. We found that the project worked, so how the heck to get it out there? And so what has happened is that this is all just happening. I'm so excited. All just happening. The VFW has joined with us. They're 2 million strong. They have made a 3-year commitment to this project, 3 years to help us distribute 600,000 books to the 600,000 caregivers caring for people with memory loss, primarily in the home. This is mostly in the home is where most people are being cared for. And we have made a $1.5 million pledge to the organizations that help us distribute and get these books out there. We've just been joined literally a half an hour ago by the United Voluntary Services. It's a wonderful group that started in 1941 as the original Army Canteen. It was a women's group that came on board railroad cars all over the world to serve coffee and sandwiches to veterans going to the front lines. And that has permuted over the years into the United Voluntary Services, where this group of people, men and women, serve veterans in veterans facilities all over the country, and they do what they can to make more positive their quality of their lives, in particular those that are disabled, and including, of course, in that, those with memory loss. I'm sorry for going on here, but I'm so passionate and so excited about this project, and I actually see how we can actually make it all happen. And I can't even, just the idea of 600,000 families having a little silver lining to a black cloud in a world where there was no cure for Alzheimer's, there's no cure for dementia, no cure. And so what this is this makes the classic lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah, let me give you my take on what you just said. There's a sentence in your promotional material. It says, life in the U.S. military contains images designed and tested to spark quiet reflection and stimulate shared reminiscence between the veteran, caregivers, old friends, and family members. Now, what I'm hearing is that the image will redefine the experience. And once you redefine the experience, your attitude toward it is completely different. And that disconnect that's there's a chemical change within the brain that'll cause an effect on Alzheimer's, whatever the case may be. So in essence, it is the image that is the quote-unquote medicine that triggers that transition from where they are to where they could be.
Well said.
That's what I heard.
Well, that's what happens. You know, the fact is that I've, as a result of immersing myself in this world for almost 5 years, sure, I've learned an awful lot about memory loss. And of course, first thing that is most important is that there are no two memory losses that are the same. Just as there are no two people the same, I use in my books, I use a thumbprint as a simile a metaphor for the fact that there are no two people alike, no two memory losses alike. So there's there's no single image that will create the same response in two different people. And so by creating a palette of general focus
universal images, universal images.
Universal images. And some register more deeply than others, and we've even put into each book several special blank sheets, so that if your dad was a sergeant and a cook in the service, you could on those blank sheets you could take a photograph or have a picture of the sergeant's stripes and put that down, and put down a big soup pot or a spatula or a white apron, and create that this is not just a memory jogger, but a personalized memory book for Pop. And so it's very purposeful in its design, that it is just simple, simple, simple. And I'll tell you what was most exciting, actually going back 5 years when I did my first three books, which was Fruits and Fun Foods and Hand Tools. And I sent the prototypes to the Alzheimer's Association because I figured, you know, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. I wasn't looking to do that. I was looking to do something that hadn't been done before, and I held my breath for several days until they called. And they said, we have the corporate initiatives folks, they said, we have the books laid out here in our executive offices. We're sitting around here looking at it. We're all shaking our heads. First of all, they are beautiful books. And second of all, why has nobody ever thought of this before? And I knew at that moment that I was really on to something. I was so excited that I jumped right into publication immediately thereafter that conversation, and we began our distribution around the country with the first three titles. But it wasn't until Life in the U.S. Military happened that magic started to happen. Talk about traction. Talk about excitement. People just almost falling all over themselves. I attended several American Legion meetings and VFW meetings to make presentations to the auxiliaries, which is the women's groups, and the organizations proper, which are made up of the military people. And to a person, to a man, to a woman, everybody loved what they saw, and they realized that we were on that they knew somebody who could use these books. And that really is the ultimate question that these days you ask: do you know somebody with memory loss, or do you know somebody who's caring for somebody with memory loss? Frankly, The answer is yes. There are very few people that don't know somebody personally or who are not involved in a circumstance with a primary caregiver. And that what this book does, what this book does is it creates an opportunity for a respite for that caregiver who frankly has the hardest job on the planet, a 24/7 job caring for a person with memory loss. It's not like any other job. It's not like any other caregiving. When you've got a person with an illness, you can say, you know, here's your TV remote, here's your coffee, I'm going to go to the store, I'll be back in half an hour. And Uncle Bob can say, well, sure, I can handle that, that'll be fine, here's your pills. But if you've got memory loss, if Grandpa's got memory loss, Grandma is not leaving that house. And so that 24/7-ness of caregiving, to break that cycle, requires that the son of Aunt Claire and the brother of Frank and the nephew of Helene can go and spend a little time with Grandpa and let Ma go walk around the block and get a breath of fresh air. What we've got to do, because it's all on us, we have to do this, is we have to make life a little easier for those folks who have the hardest job in the world, and that is caring for people with memory loss. And frankly, if you exponentially outside of the realm of those caring for veterans with memory loss, there are millions of our fellow Americans who are in any community, in every community, behind those doors, behind those windows where they're shuttered and curtained, there are people who are suffering.
Dan, let me say this to you, that and there's no way that I'm going to be able to prove what I'm going to say, but there's that old adage, you know, the old thing, that old adage, you know, you can't take a knife to a gunfight, you have to fight fire with fire. And I think what's critical here, and especially for the veterans, you see, it's the image that brought them there, and the way that you come out of it is to recreate an image that neutralizes the old image and allows the behavior to change.
Well, you know, and I think that's fine. You know, I'm no doctor, but here's what I believe is so. I think that the Jeep triggers a memory of an experience with a Jeep. I think the canteen triggers a memory of being with Frank in on bivouac and in the pup tent and laughing and playing cards and after dark, after the last bugle call. And I wonder where old Frank is. And he was so funny. And boy, we had coffee together. And wherever people go with that, in particular, let me say that my experience 20 years ago, just before Dad's passing, with grandchildren visiting with anybody who has memory loss. If a child is young, they are scared. Children are scared of people with memory loss, because they perhaps are making noises that are a little strange, or they're not talking at all. And what this book does, and that was purposeful on my part, that we trialed it in this way too, giving it to young kids and say, take this to your grandpa, sit and watch what happens when you get to the page with the Jeep. And every time we did that, never was there a scared child, five, 6, and 7 years of age were the youngest. And they sat there, Grandpa focused on the pages, little Billy focused on the pages. They were in a reverie together. They had a treasured magic moment, an incredible magic moment that perhaps that child had never, ever had with his grandpa, because, you know, unfortunately, dementia doesn't last for a week or two. It can be many, many, many years. The decline is very slow over a long period of time. And my goal as a human was to create this opportunity for others to have some magic moments, as the old American Express commercials used to say, priceless. Yeah. And that's what these moments are. I know 20 years later, after the passing of my folks, that what I retain in my mind are those magic moments when we made Pop laugh, when we made Mom laugh, when we made them go yum yum because it was something that they were eating that they loved very much, and maybe told a joke, maybe sang a little song, and that truly, as Einstein, another lay person looking at another brilliant person, my impression of Einstein was, there is no other moment like this moment right now. It is fleeting. It is here right now, but it's here right now. What are you going to do in the present? And what this does is it celebrates the present. It celebrates the present, and that's what my project is all about. It's a celebration of the here and now, and if we are smart, we can hold on to that. And it's magical, and frankly, it's a little tiny silver lining in a big black cloud. and it is, it can be something that is sustains you through sadness, is that there is something beautiful and something wonderful there, that Grandpa still can tell a great story. He can make me laugh, or his eyes are sparkling. Look at that sweet smile. And I think that what has happened in our world is we become very complacent, and we're distracted. And what this does is it causes people to focus for just a moment, And with the folks who I share this book with and who take it to others and share it, it just works, Michael Ray. It's unbelievable.
Dan, we're starting to run out of time, but it's art in and of itself is a language. It's a vibration. It's a feeling. And so is an image. And it's the image that you came onto that will cause that reaction inside that person that you're dealing with. And the image is going to trigger that emotion, and that emotion to let it go for a while, and that share that you're talking about can only happen when there is a recognizable image. You hit it. You got it. You're spot on. And with
It's Life in the U.S. Military. It's not only the name of the book, it's how you find me, Life in the U.S. Military. And even for folks who have never been in the military, when you look through this book, and any of us can look in that book, and it resonates. These are not experiences that are truly they are not unfamiliar to a person even who has not been in the military.
Dan Kaufman, I hear you loud and clear. We have to go, but I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. What a heck of a job you're doing, and thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye bye.
If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Tears and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. People say I was made for this. Nothing else would I trade.